Welcome to this episode of Physicians Weekly Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Rachel Giles from Medicom Medical Publishers in collaboration with Physicians Weekly.
Welcome to Physicians Weekly.
Later in this podcast, we have a riveting conversation with a returning guest who goes by the pseudonym Dr. Medlaw. She's a certified radiologist as well as a lawyer, and she provides five essential tips you will need to know to avoid getting patient complaints. She provides examples of common mistakes that you will definitely recognize, or if you're like me, you may have made them yourself. Always a fantastic segment.
The Physicians Weekly Podcast provides thought leader insights on the latest medical news, clinical trial coverage, and advances in medicine and healthcare.
But first, we interview a family physician and the president of the Physicians Group of Southeastern Ohio, Dr. Patrick Goggin, about bringing back house calls. When Dr. Patrick Goggin's grandfather started a primary care practice in Cambridge, Ohio back in 1930, nearly 100 years ago, the quote-unquote house call was a common practice. Recently, Dr. Goggin and his brother Mark, who are both partners of the Medical Associates of Cambridge, saw a need to bring back the house call and adapt the practice to better serve their senior population. At the time, Medical Associates of Cambridge had just entered a partnership with Agilon Health to transform a new strategy of value-based care that treats, quote, the whole patient and not the disease, end quote. Now, when many of their patients are unable to get in for their regular or annual wellness exams, doctors and nurses make house calls to those who are chronically ill and homebound. Enjoy listening. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Goggin. Can you tell us a little bit about your decision to bring back house calls? Where did that come from?
In our practice, at the onset of the pandemic, we were seeing that many of our most vulnerable patients either weren't coming to the office, weren't able to come to the office because of their health status, you know, whether that was challenges of transitions or transportation because of their health, or they were avoiding the office or other public areas to reduce their risk of exposure to infection. We were very concerned that we were going to see health declines. You know, we saw that they weren't getting their health maintenance checks. Some of them weren't able to participate in disease management, and we were fearful that this was going to, you know, lead to a decline in their health. We quickly onboarded virtual visits, and that was helpful. But many of our most vulnerable patients didn't have the technology they needed. You know, they didn't have computers or smartphones, or they were in an area of our network without adequate cellular coverage. So that often wasn't an option for them either. So we decided to resurrect the house call.
I see. And how did that work practically?
There's a nurse practitioner that I knew in the area. I knew her when we worked in the wards together. And also we knew her because she had worked for several years as a registered nurse for hospice. So she had experience in making house calls, doing home visits for very complex and sick patients, and had that really that background in palliative care. So we reached out to her as a pilot in my practice initially to start a home visit program for primarily our seniors with complex medical needs and often palliative care needs. And she was open to that. And that's how we started. This home care program that we've kind of resurrected or are designing and redesigning really is close to home for me. My brother and I work in a practice where we trained under and worked with our father for many years. And he picked up the practice when he joined in partnership with his father-in-law, our grandfather. So grandpa and grandma, his nurse was our grandma, started our family's practice back in the 1930s. And back then they did house calls as a routine part of their weekly care. So to now, you know, 90, almost 100 years later, to go back to the home and sort of like kind of expand on what grandpa and grandma started so many years ago is very rewarding.
Oh, I see. Okay. And was that a sort of a meaningful transition towards value-based care as well? Was that part of the discussion at that point?
Yes, it happened really in parallel, you know. So, you know, as you know, the modern day landscape, built on a fee-for-service model really had created unfavorable economics for primary care practices like ours. We were seeing, as we started to become involved in global risk contract, especially with Medicare patients, that our most sick and most complex patients often had much of the what we saw as unnecessary utilization, you know, whether it was ER visits or seeing specialists, maybe more often than we felt they needed to, and certainly hospitalizations and readmissions, that we felt that this initiative was strategic for our value-based care initiatives, you know, in line with being just the right thing to do for our sickest, most complex cohort of patients.
And did you see improved outcomes from those patients as well? Were you able to measure that?
We are. It's early yet. So the metrics are early, but many of the initiatives that we've designed specifically for our highest risk patients, hospital follow-up appointments in the either in the office virtually or in the home within 2 business days, we've more than doubled that just in 2022. And we feel that's one of the initiatives, not the only one, but one of the initiatives that's helping to drive down our ER and hospital utilization and drive down our readmissions.
Are there communities that are benefiting more from this preferentially than others? And can we use this when we're climbing out of the pandemic and trying to get back to normality? Is this something that we can implement in a more structured manner?
Well, I think this home care program and the centralized care management team is really that's one of our chief goals, is to fill in those gaps of inequitable care. So those patients who have transportation challenges, who have technology challenges, who have limited social support, those are the patients that we're really reaching out to, whether that's a call from a RN care coordinator, a home visit by Dylan, our nurse practitioner, a social worker, either by phone or virtual visit or in the home. That's how we're trying to fill in those gaps, yes.
So what are some of the top challenges independent of primary care practices currently?
I think the top challenges are that our practices, our primary care practices, were built on a fee-for-service model. We felt that the only way to survive was to see more and more patients and less time. We felt like we were on a treadmill that just kept going faster and faster. Meanwhile, our patients were getting older, they were getting sicker, they needed more of our time, not less, and they had more complex social determinants of health. It wasn't a good model for the doctors, and absolutely wasn't good for our patients, and we knew that. So we needed a new business model. We needed a partner that aligned with what we knew was best for our patients, taking more time with our patients, providing more comprehensive services. We needed to, you know, a partner that could align those initiatives with financial success. And that's what led us to Agilon Health. And that's when we formed our partnership with Agilon in 2019. That partnership has really, you know, having that experienced partner that in multiple other markets has been successful in helping develop these value-based care initiatives, that partnership has really helped our independent practices start to redesign our workflow. So now that we can spend more time with our patients and provide a higher level of care now than we've ever been able to before.
Wonderful. And beyond what you've already mentioned, what kind of home care services are being offered?
Well, as I said, we have a nurse practitioner and occasionally doctors and social workers who do home visits. During those visits, we can do problem-based visits or even urgent visits. We could do more like chronic disease management visits. We can even do annual wellness visits in the home. And along those lines, we have the capabilities to draw blood, do COVID and flu shots in the home, return the blood samples to our central lab and have results within a couple of hours. We're even doing COVID vaccines in the home now, too. You know, centrally, we have support from social workers, RN care managers, and clinical pharmacists, and they're also able to, you know, provide additional services.
Are these solely limited to the senior patients, or are you extending these to other patients as well?
So our partnership with Agilon is designed to manage all of our Medicare patients. So the vast majority of those are senior patients, but our home care program, while it's closely aligned with our initiatives with Agilon, that is independent and that's part of our practice. And we're doing that for any patient who sees that need, regardless of who their payer is or if they have insurance at all.
Just to put a different spin on things, could you put this in a broader context?
I do believe that this is closely tied with our development of a palliative care approach, an approach to symptom management for patients who have complex and, you know, usually incurable disease to improve their quality of care and quality of life. I think this helps those patients upstream of when they're at an end of life situation or when they may be candidates for hospice. I do believe that there's, you know, evidence that when we take a more palliative approach with these patients with chronic conditions, we are going to see better outcomes. We see so often as primary care physicians, we see that last 3 or 6 months of life when in so many cases, it involves multiple visits to the specialist, procedures, hospitalizations, readmissions to the hospital. And in the end, you wonder if you really did best serve that patient and that there was so much, I think, low value utilization of healthcare in those last months of life so often that we do a disservice to our patients. And it's created this economic structure that's economic. So I do believe the home care program really goes hand in hand with a palliative care approach to take better care of those patients, improve their quality of life for the time that they have with lessening some of this low value utilization.
That's right. And it seems to me like the biggest picture here is that it's trying to bring the primary care physicians back into the central role of care coordination. Would you agree with that statement?
Absolutely. Which is not to lessen the emphasis on specialists, but we just feel that we are able to help our patients navigate that more efficiently and organize that for them. One of the initiatives we're doing in this value-based care model is the analytics that we have access to on the specialists in our region. So we're able to see their quality scores, their readmission rate, their rate of which implanted joints might get infected, their overall cost of care. And this helps us kind of have a shared decision approach with our patients and with their caregivers to say, well, I know that your uncle saw this orthopedic surgeon, but what we found is that by using this group, you're more likely to have a better outcome and avoid complications. That sort of discussion to help guide our patients to high value specialists. So yes, in many ways, not just that one, I do believe that keeping primary care physicians more engaged in a patient-centric model is going to result in better outcomes, both better patient satisfaction and better patient outcomes.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. I hope you have a great day at your practice, and thank you for sharing your story.
All right. Thanks a lot for your time. I've enjoyed talking to you today.
Physicians Weekly is back again with our regular contributor, Dr. Medlaw, a board-certified radiologist and medical malpractice attorney. Dr. Medlaw, thank you for being here.
Great to be here.
So no one likes to be complained about.
True, and doctors like it less. You know, doctors often feel like everyone who's not a doctor is judging them, you know, waiting to pounce. The result is that once a complaint process starts, doctors tend to turn into their own worst enemies. And the goal should really be to be alert to a situation starting and to stop it. Or if things have already hit the fan, to respond in a way that controls it. Can I tell you my 5 rules of preemptive risk management? Number 1. No one who has their own problem to deal with cares about your issues. 2, inflexibility only makes it worse. 3, what you say will eventually be retold by someone else in a way that only serves their purposes. So you have to have foresight when you speak. 4, what you don't do initially on terms that you control, you will definitely end up doing eventually under circumstances that are a lot worse for you. And 5, what you don't document to your advantage in your words, the other side will later say to your disadvantage in theirs. Can I tell you a story about a doctor?
Absolutely. Please do.
Okay, now this doctor was not a difficult physician with poor social skills. He normally had really good relationships with patients and staff, but he got caught in a spiral of events. So the hospital had a protocol under which he would give the ER an initial authorization for a treatment. Another doctor would admit the patient, and he would then evaluate the patient the next day. So he was called by the ER doctor about such a case. He gave the authorization and finished his work and went home. A couple hours later, he was called by a nurse to tell him that the family of the patient, who was still in the ER because there was no ICU bed yet, wanted to talk to him because they were upset about what's going on. So he explained that the ER doctor and the admitting physician were the only ones who had seen the patient, that he wouldn't do so until the morning, and that he had nothing to add at that point, but that he would definitely talk to the family when he had seen the patient the next day. So that was all fine. He had provided a clarification of the situation that the nurse probably was unaware of. Then he snatched the beginning of a complaint from the jaws of satisfaction. He told the nurse that a physician would be expected to be making the call to him if there was an actual reason warranting his return.
I think I see rule one about to be broken, that the person on the other end does not care about your issues.
Exactly. The nurse was caring for a patient who actually belonged in the ICU. She was juggling an upset family. And the doctor, although he was technically correct on protocol, it just sounded like he was calling her an annoying underling who was unworthy to even contact him. So he had thereby not only lost a valuable ally in dealing with the family, but it actually antagonized the only available person on site to be his spokesperson. And then the doctor then reiterated that consulting on this protocol does not normally occur in the ER.
So that's rule two, being inflexible.
Yep. That was just reiteration for its own sake, and it didn't even make sense because the patient really was an ICU patient. She was just waiting for a bed and doing that waiting in the ER. If it was appropriate to see her, the location was not the issue.
I'm guessing that the consequences of breaking rule three happened next, and the nurse related the conversation in a way that slanted differently.
That's exactly what happened. So the now annoyed nurse talks to the family, and she tells them that the doctor is refusing to return because the case is not an emergency. Now, this may have been technically true, but it gave a very different impression than what the doctor intended. The doctor should have stopped using the nurse as a conduit and instead should have personally spoken to the patient's husband on the phone, explained the situation, and assured him that they definitely would meet the next day for a detailed discussion, when he had some solid information to provide. The doctor felt a little uncomfortable about how the situation had been left, so he called back a few hours later. The nurse said that the patient had been transferred to another facility by the admitting physician. It broke the fourth rule. I usually use the fourth rule, that what you don't do initially on terms that you control, you'll end up doing eventually under circumstances that are worse for you. With regard to radiologists like me being called in to do a study that can actually wait for a few hours, it's always been my practice to come in at 4:30, even if the study could actually wait for the 7 a.m. morning schedule, because by then everyone else on the case will be singing a narrative about all the compromises they had to make without the study, blaming me. So when the doctor in our example called hours later, he actually flagged his prior refusal to come in as suspect, allowing the narrative to become one that was about refusal. A few days later, risk management contacted him to tell him that the family had made a complaint. The family said that when the nurse asked him to see the patient, that he'd said, "I'm not coming back. I'll see her tomorrow. It's not an emergency." And they also waxed on about how compassionate they thought that the nurse and the admitting physician were, and mentioned that they had later apologized for the doctor's conduct. So the doctor was really angry at being complained about when he felt that he had done nothing wrong, and he feared that this was the opening salvo in a lawsuit, and so he wrote a statement that he thought established his non-liability. And what he actually did, though, was smash right into Rule 5, that what you don't say to your advantage in your words, the other side will say later to your disadvantage in theirs.
This usually applies to documentation in the chart, right?
Yeah, the chart is both the first and last best chance to set down events as you will later want them to be understood. In this case, though, it applied after the fact when the doctor wrote his statement. He first started, you know, celebrating Festivus. He was airing his grievances about protocol departures and his dealing with the ER that he thought showed their faults. He made some interpersonal comments about the nurse and the ER doctor and the admitting doctor that made him sound very dismissive. He referred to the physicians by their names, but everyone else only by their status, like the patient, the nurse, the patient's husband. And he described the family as demanding his return. Now, that's a very charged use of words in a situation in which he was being accused of treating them offhandedly. What he didn't do, though, was simply explain what he had correctly said at first, that he was just not the right doctor to assist the family at that time. He should have stated the protocol and his limited role in it at that point, and then been clear that he explained that when he was called, and had asked the nurse to assure the patient's family that he would see her in the morning to evaluate the treatment and speak to them at that time. This would have been an opportunity for a reviewer to say to themselves, you know, I see how a miscommunication occurred, but I don't see a doctor who failed to treat a family with respect.
So you had rules for how to preempt a complaint. Do you have rules for how to blunt one?
I do, but there's only four this time. Number one, even though you are defending yourself, don't be defensive. That just piques a reviewer's interest in what more might be going on. Two, remember that your standard is always to be reasonable under the circumstances, not just medically, but interpersonally. You want to show that you were reasonable at each step. Three, and this is really important, allow the complainers to save face if possible. Remember that your goal is to stop the problem, not to win an ongoing fight. And by the way, that can really impress a reviewer. They know that you're seething. So showing that you can put professionalism and respect for patients and staff members first, even when you're angry, will go a long way. And number four, be as brief as possible and use simple declarative sentences. This not only keeps the reviewer on track with your story, but it prevents you from wandering off into statements that you'll regret later. And the best way to know that you've done it right is that you won't be happy with the result. If you're emotionally unsatisfied, it will mean that you focused on what really matters in the situation rather than how you were made to feel. But remember, putting an unjustified complaint behind you is the best feeling of all.
Dr. Medlaw, as always, thank you for joining us.
And thanks for a chance to talk about this important topic.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Physicians Weekly Podcast. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.